Okay, so welcome. Good to see you all. I'm back from Constance, back from Hong Kong. I'm back in Constance from Hong Kong, and so finally I can enjoy good weather without having to run from air-conditioned hotel room to air-conditioned conference venue and back, because you couldn't really stand this heat. It's tropical, you know. I would like to begin this lecture with an apology, because according to the calendar of lectures that I had, I was fully convinced that I would have to give the career concerns lecture today. Now, 2 hours ago, when I opened the lecture slides to refresh my memory about career concerns, I realized, to my horror, that I actually had given a lecture on career concerns 2 weeks ago. You may have vague memories of this interesting lecture, right? So, and then it dawned upon me, I realized painfully that I had skipped the darker side of monetary incentive lecture. Right, so today we're doing the darker side of monetary incentives lecture, which was announced in the beginning of the course, which is in the course schedule. So there's nothing, you know, sort of out of the ordinary. I just forgot about it completely, but now we have this lecture. Here it is. It's in Ilias. I uploaded it 5 minutes ago. So for that, I am especially sorry. I was really often convinced that I didn't have to do anything because I had the career concerns online and everything was okay. But now, I had given them already, so I have to create new content online. So, the darker side of incentives, it's not really a lecture with mathematics, so people can take a sigh of relief. It's not going to be Bayesian updating. The Bayesian updating is going to be next lecture, so stay tuned. But today is going to be just hand waving. Very interesting hand waving, because the question before us during this lecture is a question: can incentives be too strong? Can incentives be too strong? Now, the economic theory that we have studied so far in this course says, no, incentives can't be too strong. If anything, incentives can be too weak. And we have seen situations in which the strength of incentives is less than one, and therefore the optimal effort under linear incentives, is not first best, is below first best. So we have seen that in the performance in another lecture, we have seen that the strength of incentives is related to the precision with which a certain performance outcome is measured, and because this precision is never perfect, the strength of incentives is never the strongest possible, right? So the question, can incentive be too strong, from the basic economics point of view, has one clear answer: no, incentive can't be too strong. But if you just step out of the ivory tower, and then you will see two things. First, that not all firms use incentives. We think that not all firms use incentives because incentives are too weak, right? Given the imperfections of performance measurement, given the multitasking, given the equal compensation principle, given the size of the firm and the 10-year trade-off between incentives and risks, all these considerations that we have surveyed earlier on in the course imply that incentives are not strong enough to generate enough profit for firms to adopt the incentives. Well, guess what? Not all firms practice incentives. That's true, but the reasons why not all firms practice incentives are not only because incentives are too weak, but also because incentives are too strong. What do we mean by incentives being too strong? Two things, and this is what today's lecture is really about. Incentives can be so strong that people who are subjected to these incentives can as psychology literature calls it, choke under pressure. Do you know what choke under pressure is? Do you know what choking is? This is what choking is, right? So incentives can put so much psychological pressure on people that they will work themselves to death, and you know, they will suffer all sorts of negative consequences, such as stress, such as lack of attention, such as cognitive deficit, and at the end of the day, these cognitive impairments that strong incentives may bring will also affect ultimate performance outcomes, surprisingly, in the negative direction. You would have thought the stronger incentives get, the harder people work, the more output they create. No, it's not true. It's not universally true that the harder people work, the more output they create, because they can work themselves to death, and then, of course, the output that they will create is not going to be optimal. Now, and also another dimension of today's lecture will have to do with dysfunctional behavioral responses to incentives. So incentives can be too strong, not only in a sense of literally killing people, right? Incentives can be too strong also in a sense of creating additional unexpected motivations that lead to people exerting behaviors that are not conducive to increasing the value of their organization. So people can, put simply, when incentives are too strong, people can cheat, sabotage, serve themselves at the expense of their organizations and at the expense of their teams. And of course, these, what's called dysfunctional behaviors under incentives, are not going to be liked by organizations, and sometimes incentives are not practiced because, not because incentives are too weak, but because incentives are too strong in the sense that they can generate behavioral responses that firms don't want. And we will go through some examples and theories behind choking under pressure and dysfunctional behavioral responses later on in this lecture. So, now let us start with choking under pressure. And let us now connect to the rest of the course. In the rest of the course, we have derived mathematically, so it's not really an assumption, it's a mathematical result under some other assumptions, but whatever you call it, we thought, well, from the incentive, from the very basic incentive effect of incentive pay, we learn that the stronger incentives get, the more effort the individual will exert under these incentives. This is your incentive constraint. And the more effort the person will exert, the more performance, the better performance outcome this person will achieve. None of these statements is universally true in reality. You know, mathematically they may be true, in reality they may not be very true. And the reasons why they're not true, there are many reasons why they're not universally true. One reason has to do with the uneasy trade-off, uneasy relationship between extrinsic and intrinsic motivation, which was, I think, a topic in Personnel Economics 1 course in the winter semester. So we've seen it before. Another reason could be that people simply choke under pressure. They, I don't know, freak out. They lose it. And as a result, their performance outcome is actually worse under strong incentives than it would have been under weaker incentives. We are human. We are not artificial intelligence. We are not perfect. And one important aspect in which we are not perfect is that our cognitive resources are limited. Strong incentives lay strong claims on our cognitive resources, and the deficit in the cognitive resources that strong incentives may create will, under some circumstances, result in inferior performance. This is not new. More than 100 years ago, there were two American psychologists by names Yerkes and Dodson, and they studied. They were one of the early researchers into the psychology of motivation. So they were psychologists, they were not economists, right? So, and what they found, what they observed empirically and then generalized into what has since been known as the Yerkes-Dodson theory or Yerkes-Dodson law, is the following relationship between the level of arousal and the level of performance. Now, arousal, you know, this 100 years ago, arousal didn't have the connotations it has today. The word arousal basically means how excited people are about the reward, right? So you can have a reward of 10 euros if you perform a certain task. You say, okay, great, 10 euros, okay, I'll do it. So your level of arousal will be not so high. And your performance, your effort, and your subsequent performance are going to be not zero, but they're not going to be spectacular. Now, if somebody is going to offer you, let's say, 100 euros to achieve a certain goal, you'll be more aroused, you'll be more excited, you know, your eyes will bead more, you will work harder, and you will deliver a better performance outcome. Somebody is going to offer you, let's say somebody is going to offer you 1,000 euros, then you work very hard and you'll do very well. Now imagine, somebody is telling you, okay, here's your performance target, you may or may not achieve it, but with some probability, if you put in high effort, you will achieve it. So it's the sort of the familiar setting when there is uncertainty in the performance outcome. And if you reach this target, you'll get 10 million euros and you will never have to work again. If you don't reach this target, you will get nothing. Nothing's going to happen to you. But while you're working on reaching this target, while you're working, you're very excited. And part of your excitement is your excitement about calculating the benefits of your effort and being worried about losing these benefits by screwing up. And guess what? This is an activity which takes cognitive resources in your brain, leaving less cognitive resources to support the actions and decision-making and millions of other processes, psychological processes that are involved in that lie on the interface between incentives and performance outcome. All right. So one example I like to give here when I talk about Yerkes-Dodson law is the example with public performances. You know, those of you who have done sports or arts or music or singing, basically activities, creative activities that that from time to time require public performances, you probably know the feeling. So when I was a teenager, I went to musical school. I learned how to play guitar, and I actually played rather well. The problem is I played rather well in my bedroom. When I had to play in public, my playing was much worse. Why? Because my hands were sweaty and trembling, because I couldn't stand the public. You know, it gave me so much excitement that I couldn't control myself. And of course, when you have sweaty and trembling hands, you can't press the strings, and you get it wrong. You get the melody wrong, you get the rhythm wrong, and you screw up, and you get annoyed by screwing up, and it's a failure, right? So when I'm in my bedroom, I play just for the fun of it. When I am in front of you know, a big audience of my, you know, whatever, classmates, parents, relatives, etc., my level of arousal is much higher, but it consumes a lot of cognitive resources, leaving very little to coordinate the movement of my fingers, right? So these things happen, and they happen not only with Nick, they also happen with lots of other people. How do we know? There is a very famous study by a bunch of psychologists. They are all very famous. Dan Ariely has written a number of popular books. One of them is The Upside of Irrationality, if you know. It's very, very interesting. So Uri Gnisi is also a famous psychologist. George Loewenstein is a sort of economist/psychologist, and Nina Mazar. They're all employed by top U.S. universities, very prolific academics, public speakers, etc. So this is really a paper that everybody should read. I'm not saying it's clausura relevant, but what I am saying is that this is really a piece of literature that you should read for this course. Now, this paper features several experiments. So these experiments individually are very small scale and imperfect and specific. They would probably not be published very well individually. But if you join them together, then a very robust and rich pattern of evidence emerges, which suggests that, yes, we are humans, we have limited cognitive capacity, and we do screw up because we choke under pressure. And this, of course, means, going back to the topic of our lecture and the course in general, this means that, yes, incentives can be too strong because the cognitive resources are limited. And the basic model of incentives does not take this limitation into account, because it thinks that Homo economicus is infinitely rational and infinitely clever and infinitely capable, and all that matters is the costs of effort that you can express with some deltas and epsilons. That's not the case. Now, so experiment number one, they didn't have a lot of money, so they traveled to a village in a remote part of India. So they brought whatever money they had. They hired 87 villagers in that place, in that where they were, and they showed them six different games. They were games that required different capacities, physical, mental capacities. There was creativity, there was memory, there was motor skills like playing darts, for instance. So six games played in a random order. So for each game, they measured performance, and they created a standardized measure of performance. So you can actually quantitatively assess and compare the performance of people playing darts, the performance of people playing memory or packing quarters, etc. Right? And they had three experimental conditions. They randomly assigned people into three experimental conditions. The low incentives, which offered a rather small reward for playing the game well, for reaching a good result in the game. There was the moderate incentives, which paid 10 times the amount. So now things are getting interesting and serious. And they had a condition where they paid super high incentives. Now, 400 rupees, to put it in perspective, it's 80% of the monthly food shopping. It's huge money, right? Imagine somebody is offering you this kind of cash for playing some kind of silly game, right? You say, oh, you get beady-eyed, right? You wanna be the best player of packing quarters or dartball or whatever, right? So you would expect, the basic economic theory would predict that, you know, the people here in the high incentive condition would really become world champions in playing darts, and people in the low incentive condition would show the worst performance of the three conditions. Well, without being too theatrical, these are the results. These are the regression results, and what these numbers show is they show the differences in the average performance of people playing different games between the different treatment conditions. Now, the low pay treatment condition is the baseline category. What it means? It means that, for instance, if you take packing quarters, the people playing packing quarters and receiving 40 rupees for a good play, they perform better than people receiving 4 rupees for good play for packing quarters. So far, so good. Never mind it's statistically insignificant. Never mind. It's a small sample, right? But what is a lot more interesting is that if you compare the performance of people receiving 400 rupees for packing quarters, then this performance, right, is actually negative, is actually worse than the performance of the people receiving next to nothing for this game. It's amazing, right? Okay, it's a very specific sample. People may have got confused about the purpose of this exercise, and they may not have believed that they would actually get this much money for playing a silly game. All sorts of limitations. But we see here the first signs that you actually can and do screw up in cognitively demanding tasks when you are overwhelmed by high incentives, right? So I don't know if you buy this or not, but these are the data, and it's one, you know, experiment that is actually rather famous. They even have a YouTube movie based on the results of this experiment. Now, you may not be convinced. Here is another experiment. This time we move from rural India. Forget the rural India. Let's move to the Western Hemisphere, let's really meet some brainy kids, the MIT students. Right? Can't get brainier. So they basically played, let's say, two games. They weren't really games; they were tasks. But so there was the physical task and the cognitive task. The physical task was to press the button when you hear a sound. So you hear the sound beep, and you have to press the button as quickly as possible. And you get paid depending on the time that elapses between hearing the sound and pressing the button. So you really have to be very alert, but it's not very cognitively demanding. Each time you hear a beep, you have to press the button. Beep, 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 etc. Right? And, you know, so by being fast, you could make more money. By being slow, you would make less money. And for this physical task, you could receive either 15. You could either receive low incentives, so you would get $15 for good performance and $30 for excellent performance. That's the low incentive treatment. Now things are getting more interesting. For the physical task, if you're lucky, if you're randomly assigned into the high incentive group, you could get €150 for good performance and $300 for excellent performance. Now, $300 is just a little bit under how much a room in a student dormitory costs. So it's a lot of money for this stupid pressing the button task, right? So what would you expect? You would expect people offered high incentives to perform better than people who were offered low incentives in this physical task, pressing the button. Now, and this expectation is correct. If you look at the regression results, you see that the high payment dummy has a positive and significant coefficient, which means that compared to the low payment condition, people doing physical tasks are 30-something percent more productive. So far, so good. There's a second task. The second task is the cognitive task, and this task is to add numbers. So you have two or three digit numbers, I don't remember, you see them on the screen, and you have to calculate the sum within a certain period of time. So you have to be very fast, right? So and again, you had the low incentive treatment, so you would get $15 or $30 depending on how well you're doing at calculating sums of numbers, or you could get $150 or $300 depending on how well you're doing. Okay, so you really can make lots of money by adding numbers. Yeah? Everybody can add numbers. Well, let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. Now, the baseline in this regression, the base category, is the performance of the people doing physical tasks and doing it in the low incentive treatment. So they could get $15 or maximum $30 for doing very well. Now, if you have people doing physical tasks under high payment, then their performance is way higher, right? However, if you have people under high payment and doing adding task, then the performance of the people in adding task under high payment is actually worse than the performance of people doing adding task under low payment. So there's a diversion. Physical task, stronger incentives, better performance. Additive task, cognitive task, stronger incentives, worse performance. What is going on? Let's get back to Yerkes and Dodson. Yerkes and Dodson says that there exists an optimal level of arousal. We've seen it. What it also says, and that's where things become very interesting for psychologists, what it also says is, well, the reason why there exists an optimal level of arousal is not because people don't like money. People do like money. The reason why there exists an optimal level of arousal is because High level of arousal consumes a lot of cognitive resources of your brain. So if you have two strong incentives, lots of cognitive resources of your brain will be consumed by calculating your profits and losses rather than doing the task itself, right? And this suggests that tasks putting different requirements on cognitive resources should have different optimal levels of arousal. If you have a task which is simple, physical task, which does not require a lot of cognitive resources, such as, for instance, pressing the button, then the optimal level of arousal for this task is can actually be quite high. Why? Because it doesn't take a lot of cognitive resources anyway. I mean, it just takes a lot of physical resources, which are much less limited than cognitive resources, even though they're also limited, and then just your performance just plateaus. It doesn't matter anymore. But the tasks that are difficult in terms of cognitive resources requirements, tasks that require, you know, you to think in abstract terms, tasks that require you to be creative, tasks that require you to perform some mathematical operations, right? They require a lot of cognitive effort, and therefore high levels of arousal are really detrimental for the performance in these tasks, because here all your or nearly all your limited brain capacity will be consumed by thinking about incentives and very little left to deliver performance. So to get back to the paper Large Stakes and Big Mistakes that I've been talking about so far, here we are. Physical task, low cognitive resource requirements, high performance when incentives are high. Cognitive tasks with high cognitive resource requirements, high incentives, low performance. Why? Because people are thinking about money a lot more than they think about doing sums. And when they think less about doing sums and more about calculating money, then they make more mistakes and their performance therefore suffers. Make sense? Okay. So, now here's another experiment in case you aren't impressed yet. This experiment takes another perspective to thinking about choking under pressure. So far we've been thinking about choking under pressure in terms of it being the result of excessive demands on cognitive capacity that high levels of arousal constitute, high levels of arousal make. But that's not the entire story. So let's get back to Nick playing his guitar in front of a large audience, right? And failing miserably each time because of sweaty hands. Choking under pressure may result from overexcitement, may result from recognizing that your performance is being watched, it's being monitored by a lot of people, and these people may have some ideas about you, they may like or not like you depending on your performance. Choking under pressure may result from largely self-imposed huge responsibility for the outcome of your performance, which can get you carried away and which can get you to choke under pressure. To test this idea, they had a third experiment. This time, student participants had to solve anagrams. You know what anagrams are? The combination of letters, and you had to make them out into words. Okay, so I am hopeless at solving anagrams. I have a lot of respect for people who can do them. I would score very badly in this. So whatever treatment I was in. Now, the treatments were two. One treatment was that people would solve anagrams in some sort of cubicle, not being observed by anyone, and this is the private treatment. And in the public treatment, people would be observed by other participants. People would be observed by other participants. Now, the incentives are exactly the same, or rather, there are no incentives, just, you know, looking good, being good at solving anagrams. And the performance results are very different. The performance results are very different, and what you see is that in the public condition, the performance is always worse, no matter what your econometric specification is. You're doing anagrams worse in public than in private. The same people with the same intelligence, the same skills of doing anagrams, etc., etc. Right? So you can have situations which result into choking under pressure, and strong incentives could contribute to creating such situations. For instance, in this experiment, the only incentive is to look good. And when you make this incentive very, very strong by actually putting the anagram solver in front of a large audience, instead of excelling, they freak out because they think too much about the other people rather than solving anagrams, rather than their performance. So this is the story so far. And the bottom line of this whole study is that, well, it's one of the most influential papers in the literature. I'm not saying it's the best paper in literature, but it's certainly one of the most sort of widely read and understood because it's so easy and makes a point in such a clear, non-mathematical way. And what it basically says is that you have to be careful with offering very strong incentives, because when you offer very strong incentives, people will fail in tasks requiring cognitive effort. There are many such tasks. In fact, in modern economies, almost all the tasks that matter are very cognitively demanding, right? We live in an economy of knowledge, of high-end services. My task is very cognitively demanding, for instance, so please don't give me very strong incentives. When you think about why firms don't offer very strong incentives, then this is a likely answer. But this is not the only answer, right? So people freaking out under too strong incentives is not the only answer, because almost by definition, almost I would say even tautologically, it applies to rather peculiar situations in which incentives are really, really, really strong. So surely, if you offer a little bit of incentives, you're not in the dangerous zone of the Yerkes-Dodson curve. So why not just offer a little bit of incentives, right? Why not? Because incentives have a darker side, dark side of incentives. This title is almost taken from the title of the article by a famous management consultant, Chris Cancialosi, who wrote an article in Forbes magazine, a very popular US magazine. And in that article, he complained that incentives are often designed poorly, and when incentives are poorly designed, they create behavioral responses from the incentivized people that are contrary to the intention of the principal who devised these incentives. So when we were talking about choking under pressure, we said people have limited cognitive capacities, and that's why they choke under pressure. Now we're talking about principals having limited cognitive capacities, because if they would have unlimited cognitive capacities, they wouldn't offer very strong material incentives in situations when these incentive schemes can be rather blatantly gamed. I don't remember if I've told you a very famous example about bad incentives that comes from early 20th century in what is now Vietnam. It used to be a French colony in those days, and the French administrators came to Hanoi in Vietnam, and what they saw is lots of rats running around. Have I told you this example? No? Yes? Rats? Okay, so lots of rats running around. Tropical climate, lots of food for rats, and of course they are not comfortable living among rats. They tried to kill them, but it didn't work. So what they decided to do is they decided to introduce incentives to local population who would receive some money for killing rats. And they had to measure performance. So how would you measure performance? You would establish a certain office in the Stadthaus, where there would be an official counting the numbers of dead rats and paying the locals depending on how many rats they killed. Okay. And it sort of worked. The locals started bringing in lots of rats. Wow, the incentives really work. But then there were so many dead rats around the Stadthaus that they decided to do something with it. And they said, okay, guys, look, no rats, please. Just bring us the tails of rats. They're easier to count and easier to keep. And, you know, they brought in lots of tails of rats in the Stadthaus. The incentives work. Great. Everything's great. Now, in a couple of weeks' time, they started seeing rats running on the streets without tails. So what they would do, they'd catch a rat, cut its tail, and bring the tail and get the money. And some people even started breeding rats. Because when rats breed, they have lots of little rats whose tails you can cut and bring and get your money and get these rats to breed more. So instead of reducing the population of rats, this incentive scheme actually increased the number of rats in Hanoi. And a couple of years later, there was a plague. There was a plague epidemic in Hanoi where lots of people died. You know, so this is a very, very famous example of how incentive schemes can really screw up big time, right? So such situations come under a heading, gaming the system. So how do you game the system? You learn how you can make money from a given incentive scheme, and you learn about the best way to make money under a given incentive scheme. And this best way of making money for you under a given incentive scheme may not be the way that the principal anticipates you to act. The French colonizers did not want the locals to cut rats' tails. They wanted to kill rats. But then, you know, what they didn't realize is that it's easier to cut a rat's tail rather than to kill it, or certainly more productive, because there'll be rats and lots of new rats whose tails you can cut. This is gaming the system. It exists all the time and everywhere. You hear routinely, like, you know, really a lot of times you hear situations in which account managers report fewer deals in a given year, carrying the deals over to the beginning of the next financial year. So you would see, for instance, you know, you'd have a deal completed in, say, 10th of December or 15th of December, still the current calendar year, but you will actually book this deal in the next year. Why would you do that? Because if you book too many deals in this particular year, your performance target next year is going to be higher, and you will not have deals next year. Happens all the time. What you also see is that if your number of points for the exam is, let's say, 69, and in order to get 1.3, you need a 70, right? According to the grade rules, there'll be a mass of people with 70 points and a trough in the distribution at the 69, so that there would be more people with the grade 1.3. That's also gaming the system. There we are. Here's a distribution of the point grades from England. You know, the high school kids have to take this secondary school exam in English language, and this is the distribution of grade scores. Now, there are grade rules. If you get 180 points or more, you get A+. If you get 140 points between 160, you get a B. And if you get less than 140, this is really important, then you get a C, and that means basically you're not going to get into the uni. And everybody wants to get into the uni. So what you see, look here. You see this? It's an aberration. It's the normal distribution. Normal distribution would have the frequencies going this way. You wouldn't have this little hump here, would you? Right? Why do you have it here? Or some teachers give them these extra points. What the hell? I mean, what's the difference between 69 and 70? Here you are, 70, and you get a B, and you can get into the uni. And the teachers are also better off because their statistics look better. Look how many guys went to uni from my class. Yeah. So these things happen all the time and everywhere. And when you take these different bits of information, the big picture that emerges is that there's plenty of room for various creative practices that exploit the deficiencies of existing incentive schemes to profit the agent. Now, thinking about more or less, you know, these are anecdotal evidence. But here's a paper in the Journal of Corporate Finance, one of the prime journals in the field. What they find is that CEOs, the bosses of the firms which offer stronger incentives, these guys are statistically more likely to be investigated for financial fraud. So flat incentives, basically fixed wage and a little bit of a bonus, not so likely, less likely to be investigated for fraud. Strong incentives, you can make lots of money by delivering high performance results. How do you deliver high performance results? You either deliver high performance results by working extremely hard or by doing something creative, which will make the accounting measures look very good on paper. You'll get lots of money. You know, look at Volkswagen, for instance. You know, you have these emissions scandal. You want to have very low emissions. To deliver very low emissions costs a lot of money. That will eat into your profit margins. You tinker a little bit with the test for low emissions. Your profit margins will not suffer as much. Your performance results will skyrocket because everybody will want to buy these super clean Volkswagen. The guys will help themselves to huge incentives and bonuses based on the realized profit. Then, boom, it becomes known to the public and the company suffers huge losses, and there are a lot of investigations on the way, and most of these investigations result in out-of-court settlements costing the firm how much? I think 12 billion euros so far. But don't quote me on this. It's in billions. It's many, many billions. Right. So it exists, and it's I wouldn't call it massive, but I would call it statistically non-negligible frequency, statistically non-negligible correlation between the strength of incentives and the likelihood of being implicated in financial fraud. So, how do we know it? We know it from the regression analysis, very simple framework here. You have the dependent variable, which is 0 or 1, depending on whether you are investigated for fraud or not over a certain period of time. And you correlate it with the option intensity. What is the option intensity? It's a measure of how powerful your incentives are. So the CEOs get incentive packages which include a lot of different instruments, right? You get performance bonus, but performance bonus for CEOs doesn't really work very well. Why? Because the CEOs can massage accounting figures to create lots of performance in a given year, get huge bonus, and then go and become employed in another organization. So what is cool now in the world of corporate, of executive compensation, is to offer so-called options, stock options. You know how they work? Stock options? No? Yes? Yeah? So those who are not sure how stock options work, you have a performance target. If you reach this performance target, you get a certain amount of stock options. What is stock option? Stock option is the right to buy the shares of your firm at an agreed price. Now, if your firm does well, if you're a good manager, the market value of the shares of your firm increases, the option price written in your contract stays the same. So you can buy the now higher priced shares for the lower price in your contract, and you can resell them. That's how you can cash in. Yes? Right? No. You can't cash in. You have to wait. There is now more and more of the time you get a delay. So on the 1st of January or 1st of March or whenever, you can exercise your options. By exercising options means that you can buy these shares for a lower price than the market, but you have to wait for say half a year or a year, depending on your contract, before you can sell these shares, right? So, and if you haven't been a good manager, or if for some other reason your company didn't do very well, then the share price is low, your option price is higher than the share price, and you will simply not exercise the right to buy shares at a given price. So that's how it works. Now, going back to option intensity is basically the percentage of the stock option value that one could earn, percentage of the total remuneration package. So more stock options as a percentage of your total remuneration package means, of course, stronger incentives because you can make more money this way. A lower share of stock options in your package means that the incentives are weaker. And guess what? The more option intensity there is in your remuneration package, the more likely you are to have spoken to the financial police about the cases of fraud in your organization. Now, so here's another piece of evidence that I would like to present to your attention. This is experimental evidence on cheating under incentives. So not only do you game the system, not only do you get engaged into accounting practices that are frowned upon by the current legislation, you can actually also cheat under incentives. Sure, right? You have midterm exams. People don't really cheat because the stakes are not very high. You have final exams, and that's when the frequency of cheating is typically higher. That's when cheaters are caught most of the times, etc. Right? You can also sabotage under high incentives. And here's an example. Here's an experimental study in management science, and it's one of the top journals in management, so I'm not peddling some unknown research to you. It's really the prime research that exists now. By three people, of whom the most famous are Marie-Claude Villeval and Gary Charnas, very famous in the world of behavioral economics. They ran this experiment with student participants, so no real firms, but interesting nevertheless. So they got people to do a certain task. I forgot which task, it's not very important, right? What is important is that people did this task under different conditions. So the baseline condition, the control if you like, is this task would be performed in a group of three participants, so it's a sort of team task, and they would just perform this task without any explicit incentives, the wage is fixed, and there is no performance feedback, so no one will even know how good you have been at doing this task. So it's really an excellent way to waste some of the grant money that they received to run this experiment. Now, here comes a more interesting treatment, the ranking treatment, which is the same as the baseline, except that now feedback is provided. So every participant learns about how good they are at anagrams or memory game or whatever it is that they do together, right? And this is the sort of incentives that the authors generate in their experiments. So they don't offer monetary incentives, interestingly. They offer incentives in the form of recognition. But we know from Personnel 1 that incentives in the form of recognition are important. Do these incentives in the form of recognition work? Oh, yes, they do. If you look at the results, this is the baseline performance, very low, relatively low. And this is the performance when ranking is offered. So when you hear feedback about your performance, you want to do well. See, it generates a massive, massive performance effect. Okay, now let's move on. The third treatment was the treatment which is the same as ranking, so you have information about your performance relative to your peers, which offers you incentives in the form of status and recognition, but in this treatment, you're allowed to sabotage. What is sabotage? Sabotage is a costly effort. It's an action which has some costs. It's a costly effort which does not create any output but destroys the output created by others. Now imagine you are a principal employing teams of people and you offer them relative performance feedback as a sort of status-related incentives. What's going to happen? They will receive an incentive to work hard, that's true, but they will receive another incentive, and this other incentive is to sabotage. Right? You can be number one by producing, you know, 100 chairs when the rest of your team produced only 50 chairs. Or you can be number one by producing one chair when the rest of your team produced zero. Clearly, for the organization as a whole, these two outcomes are very different. But for you, these two outcomes are not that different, right? You're number one, and that's who you want to be. What is the treatment effect of the sabotage treatment? Well, this is sabotage, the gray line, and it's in between. It's in between the unincentivized condition, where people don't care, and the super high incentivized condition, where people care about their status. Now, notice there is a considerable difference in performance between the ranking and sabotage. And the only difference between these two treatments is that in the rankings, you're not allowed to sabotage. But when you are allowed to sabotage, you help yourself. So not only do you waste your money destroying other people's output, you actually destroy quite a lot of this output so that the average team performance suffers a lot. It's still higher than without incentives, but the positive effect of incentives is severely reduced by this additional dysfunctional behavioral response which people are allowed to exercise in this sabotage treatment. Now, finally, there is another treatment, redemption. It's the same as sabotage, it's the same as ranking. So, except that here you're not allowed to sabotage, you're not allowed to destroy people's output, but you're also, but what you are allowed is you are allowed to act like those CEOs or managers who have very strong incentives. You are allowed to use creative accounting to blow up your own output, right? So instead of producing 10 chairs, you say, I've produced 150 chairs, of which 140 are with the hedge fund in Cayman Island, which they used as a collateral to participate in another hedge fund, blah, 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 blah. Never find these 140 chairs. They will only exist on paper. But for accounting and financial analysts, this will be good enough data to award you another bonus in the year. So for a certain cost, you can actually increase your own output in order to look good. What happens? Well, this is your redemption treatment, and the performance results of the redemption treatment are actually closer to the performance outcome of the just ranking treatment, which sort of gives you a glimmer of hope, because what it says is that, well, incentives work. The performance, the outcome of incentives is severely influenced by dysfunctional behavioral responses, but you can still design, you can still try to influence people's propensity to engage themselves into dysfunctional behavioral responses by allowing them to sabotage versus allow them to creatively account, right? So what is better, to allow people to sabotage or to allow people to creatively account? If you can't help it, you're better off allowing people to creatively account. So they will just increase, everybody will increase their output. Of course, the real output will not change. Their reported output will be somewhere here. But if everybody is engaged in this sort of activity, they will, you know, if everybody has the same propensity to engage in this sort of activity, then what will really make a difference in the end, what will really determine their position in the relative rankings, is their actual performance, which is measured here and which is not that much different from their performance in the ranking conditions when they are not allowed to creatively account. So this is sort of quasi-optimistic message from this experiment. So there's a pessimistic, there's a bad message saying that people sabotage when they can, but the sort of half optimistic message is that if you allow people to satisfy their pride and to creatively account, then it's not going to have a lot of detrimental effect on performance. All you need to do, of course, is to anticipate the propensity of people to creatively account and adjust your incentive schemes to take this into consideration. So when I sit, so a small story that to me illustrates this creative accounting story. I sit from time to time in selection committees that select people for master programs in the university in Konstanz, right? A master in economics or graduate school. And we receive applications from German students, which are very easy to deal with because they know which universities they come from. And I know what 1.3 is and what 2.7 is. But we also receive a lot of international applications and a lot of applications from the Middle East. And in many of these applications, the people who write them, they say, I belong to the top 2% of performance in my class. And some people say, I belong to the top 0.7% of performance in my class. Or I belong to the top 0.01% performance in my class. I was number one on the Iranian Mathematical Olympiad or whatever, right? So, of course, I'm an economist and I simply discount this as cheap talk. How, I mean, I don't care about your self-reported performance ranking. But guess what? They think that there is a sort of reward for their percentile in group performance. There may be a reward. They may try and have their cheap talk persuasive enough to impress some less experienced people in the selection committee. But at the end of the day, it's their TOEFL and GRE, the formal test results, that will largely determine their performance. So you can boast. You can say I belong to the top 0.5% of the distribution. It doesn't matter. As long as you also work hard to do well on the objective test, it's okay. All you need to do as a principal is simply offer very small or zero incentives to this, to the behaviors, to the outcomes, which can be influenced by actions that resemble the redemption treatment in this study. Does it make sense? Yeah. So next time you see someone who is boasting about their relative performance, you say, oh, yes, yes, wow, cool, excellent. Now show me your GRE test or show me your, you know, show me your grade for personnel economics and then I will be better informed about your true ability. Yeah. So, okay. Now, let's move on. The last thing I have to, the last thing I wanted to say about this study is to show a bunch of regression results, which are impossible to read, I know, but what, you know, of course, you read this paper in when you can. And the lesson that you should learn from this is that people actually use redemption and sabotage. They use redemption and sabotage, and they use it in a non-random way. So, two findings here. First, there is a demand for redemption and sabotage. And it's an important finding, because if you say that incentives can be too strong because people will engage in sabotage, you have to answer a question, do people engage in sabotage? And these regression results show that people do engage in sabotage. Now, the second finding that we discover from these results is the propensity to engage in sabotage, is it the same for everybody or are there differences? And what we see is that actually there is, as the theory would predict, people who are performing relatively badly, people who need to advance their position, they spend more resources on sabotage and redemption. So if you are really a top 5% student, you will write, I'm a top 5% student. But if you are top 95% students, you'll be more likely to write, I'm more like half top 0.5% student, because you need to advance your cause you need to create a fake performance result about you to try and deceive the principal more than the person who genuinely is performing very well will ever need. Okay, well, let's conclude. We are a little bit earlier today, but that's okay, I guess, given the weather. So what did we learn today? We learned that incentives can be too strong. And what do we mean by incentives being too strong? Beta being too high, yeah? So what do we mean beta being too high? The highest possible, the optimal beta is beta equal to 1. And the typical beta is less than 1. What are you talking about? Of course incentives are not too strong. Well, wait a moment. Incentives can be too strong even for betas less than 1. Because what our theories still lack is, or have lacked until today, is the realization that cognitive capacity of human brain is limited, and the very fact of performance under incentives has increasing demands on cognitive capacity, which demands continue to increase as incentives become stronger and stronger and stronger. So these extra demand extra demand on the brain's cognitive capacity that stronger incentives introduce will result in choking under pressure. And we have seen, I think, abundant evidence. And we can relate what's even better, we can relate this evidence to our individual experiences. At least I certainly can. Now, incentives can also be too strong in another sense, complementary to choking under pressure. Incentives can also be strong in the sense that they can create additional motivations, unexpected or hard to control, by the designers of these incentives. And these incentives, these motivations have to do with gaming the system, which is totally counterproductive. And these incentives have to do with fraud, which is obviously very counterproductive. And these incentives also have to do with sabotage, artificially, you know, purposelessly destroying the other people's output in order to look good on their background, and creative accounting, or what Charnas and company call redemption, basically blowing up your performance results so as to look good in relative terms. So in these two aspects, incentives can be too strong, and firms who operate in the environments which can give rise to either choking under pressure or dysfunctional behavioral responses will find it optimal either to reduce the strength of incentives or not practice incentives at all. Thank you.